From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, The Exchange goes in-depth, looking at mental health care in New Hampshire. It's a system once viewed as top-notch, but that has eroded over the past two decades to the point where a 2013 court settlement forced the state to make improvements and to submit to regular reviews. Now, almost 5 years later, is it better? That's what we'll ask all this week on The Exchange. Today, we begin with an overview, and later in the hour, our Race for the First series continues as we introduce you to the many candidates running for the first congressional district. Today, it's Democrat Mark McKenzie. As always, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Katya Fox. She's director of the Division for Behavioral Health at New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. And Katya, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Also with us, Ken Norton, executive director of NAMI-NH. That's the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Ken, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Great to be back.
Well, Ken, so is it better? Is the state's mental health system better today than it was, you know, 4.5 years ago or so when this settlement was signed?
It's a really difficult question. And I think that for a lot of people that are using the system right now, the answer would be no.
Really?
Well, when we're looking at the numbers of people waiting in emergency rooms and people kind of stacked up in crisis, the answer is no. But it's the less visible, the answer is definitely yes. And those are people that are receiving housing supports through the mental health settlement agreement, mobile crisis response in three communities in Concord, Manchester, and Nashua, and other supports as well. And I think that some of the steps that have been taken since the settlement agreement are definitely moving us in the right direction. And again, those aren't necessarily visible, but planning for the 10-year plan and legislation moving different pieces forward, the children's system of care, all those things are definitely better.
So that's interesting, Ken. So it sounds like systemically, there are some things going on that you feel positive about, but in terms of just basic measurements, numbers, people waiting, people needing, those aren't necessarily better.
And those are the most visible pieces of the system, I think.
And the human pieces of
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
People suffering.
And when we talk about the settlement agreement, it was only about adults, so it didn't include children. And it also, while it does speak to individuals who are incarcerated with mental illness, it doesn't really go very in-depth there, and that's also a less visible but still very challenging and important piece of the mental health system.
Well, and you're setting up the rest of this series really well, because tomorrow in the series we're going to be looking at children and youth, and then on Wednesday we will look at the intersection of mental health and the criminal justice system. Katya, what about you? What do you think? What's better and what isn't?
So I appreciate Ken's comments. What I think that we need to do is look back a little bit farther and to 2008. So in 2008 is when the last 10-year mental health plan was put into place. Fast forward 10 years and think about what happened over that period of time. So we had a recession hit and we had funding issues. And so we had an erosion of the infrastructure of the system that people are relying on. So since that time, we've had the opportunity, and we really have an opportunity right now, to invest in that infrastructure and to rebuild the system. And so what we've been able to do is to put in the supports and the community supports that are really needed that we hope and know will make a difference in the future. So that infrastructure development is ongoing. It's happening now as a result of a lot of efforts by a lot of people. And I think that we will start to see a difference when we talk about individuals.
Well, and in a minute, I want to ask both of you what that infrastructure really is, especially for people who don't interact with the system day to day. But speaking of the commitment, Katya, we got an email from a listener, didn't give his or her name, but this person says, the problems facing the mental health system aren't unsolvable. They just need to be made a priority by the legislature. This person asks, what will it take to make that happen? And I want to thank this person for submitting his to her question. What do you think, Katya?
Well, I think under the leadership of Commissioner Myers from HHS, as well as our governor and our legislature, there is a commitment, and that commitment is being demonstrated through funding. So we had funding through the budget and through HB 400 and 517, which was the budget bill last year. There were serious dollars that were invested into the system, including housing supports, which are so important. We just had another session that wrapped up, and there were additional investments in allowing us to be more flexible in the funding that we do have so that we can meet those needs. So there's plenty of opportunity, and I think there is commitment. I think we have people like Chief Justice Broderick who are putting a real face to this and addressing the stigma issues. And we have Ken Norton, who has been steadfast and is really, his voice is being heard, and some of his efforts are paying off.
One of the things that I've heard, Ken, I've heard other people say what Katya is saying, is that there are more resources from the legislature now, that this is a better moment in terms of funding, but that there just aren't the professionals to provide the care. So maybe there's funding, maybe a person actually has the dollars that it takes to seek care, but he or she can't find a provider.
Workforce capacity is a huge issue right now, not just in the mental health system, but
everywhere.
Across healthcare and everywhere. I mean, when we have an unemployment rate of, you know, below 2.5%, it's a challenge. And I think one of the things that's very difficult when the conundrums about having a series like this, when we talk about all of the challenges that the system faces, is that how do we message to young people that there are great jobs and just wonderful, fulfilling professions by working with people with serious mental illness? And, you know, there are certainly challenges, and it is difficult work, but it is wonderful work. And I think that that's an important message that we need to get out.
So make the case then, because a lot of other sectors are also making that case. Hey, it's a great time to work in manufacturing. Hey, it's a great time to work in tourism. So how do you sort of cut through that, Ken, and say to a young person, this is why you should do this, even though it's going to be emotionally challenging, I'm guessing, and maybe the pay isn't great?
Well, I guess I have to answer that on a personal question and just say that, you know, that I've had just an amazing career, and I've been in people's homes. I've been in maternity units. I've been in funeral homes. I've been in prison. I've been in jail. I've seen people at their worst. I've been to graduations. I've been, you know, involved in people's lives in a way that I wouldn't otherwise, that has really helped me grow personally and helped me with raising my family. And I've been able to, you know, not get rich, but certainly lead a middle-class lifestyle and be a much better person than I was before I got into the mental health field.
Well, one more question about funding. Katya, I have read that the community mental health centers in the state are still reimbursed by the state 2006 levels? That was a long time ago. So all this funding that you talked about, is some of that going to go to ramp that up?
Actually, that is something that we are looking at. We're working very closely with New Hampshire Community Behavioral Health Association and taking a look at those rates, because we do know that the rates are set from 2006. We are working with our actuary to see what it would mean to make further investments. But yes, very much so. That's something that we need to do.
And who sets those rates? Is it the state or the feds? Because I know Medicaid is a state and federal match.
So the state sets the rates, and those need to be actuarially sound through a process for our managed care program.
So actuarially sound means basically it won't bust the budget.
Right. Well, no, it won't. I guess I'll leave it at that.
So why is it still set at 2006? I mean, most companies, you know, try and give their workers at least a raise that keeps pace with inflation. So I'm just wondering how you resolve those workforce shortage issues that you guys both talked about, paying people, you know, the rates that they were paid 12 years ago. My goodness.
It's a significant concern. And again, we're making steps to look at those rates and to do what we can to increase them. When times were tough in 2008 and beyond, it was one place where there was some leeway to be able to reduce rates, and we need to get back and build those back up. One thing I do want to mention based on the workforce issue is the student loan repayment program has been very successful in helping us recruit and retain qualified staff for the community mental health system. And the recent efforts by the legislature, soon to be signed by Governor Lynch, by Governor Sununu, will invest another $700,000 into that program. So there is recognition there that there needs to be the workforce and qualified.
So if a young person goes into the mental health field, they will get some level of student debt reimbursement? Katya, how's that going to work?
So it works. It's a program that someone, once they're placed, they get a repayment of their student debt over a period of time, and they make a commitment to stay with that particular program.
All right. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us today in The Exchange. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today, The Exchange goes in-depth with a look at mental health care in New Hampshire. This is the first of four shows that we're going to do this week. We're beginning with an overview of the major components of our mental health system, where it works, where the holes are. Later on in the hour, it's our Race for the First series with Democrat 1st Congressional District candidate Mark McKenzie. Let's get your questions and comments in now, though, about the mental health system here in New Hampshire. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And both of you, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Andrew Milne is on the line, staff attorney with the Disability Rights Center of New Hampshire. That's the group that brought that lawsuit several years ago that I mentioned at the beginning of the show that ended in a settlement and a commitment to make the mental health system better. Andrew Milne, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
What was the bottom line, Andrew, of this lawsuit that your organization brought? The biggest problem that you guys saw in terms of the rights of Granite Staters with mental illness?
The biggest problem, the bottom line, is unnecessary institutionalization, meaning that, and this is a standard that comes from the Americans with Disabilities Act, where the Supreme Court has interpreted the ADA to mean that people with disabilities who could be living integrated lives in the community, but instead are receiving treatment in institutional facilities like the state hospital or the state nursing home, they are unnecessarily segregated, and that's a form of discrimination under the ADA. So the intent of the lawsuit was to assert those rights to receive community-based treatment where appropriate. And the United States Department of Justice joined in our suit to represent its interest in enforcing that federal anti-discrimination law.
So it was sort of a form of segregation almost, not providing people the treatment in the communities where they could be living, you know, near or with friends and family, working perhaps. It was this more segregation, yes, in these large institutions.
Exactly.
So what do you think is better, Andrew? You know, it's been almost 5 years since this thing was signed.
Yeah, so there have been some really important concrete benefits to that class of individuals at risk of unnecessary institutionalization. I'd love to briefly mention a couple of them, as well as where there are still areas of improvement. Mobile crisis response has been a big benefit in the three communities where that has been implemented, as well as supported housing throughout the state. The mobile crisis is where a person in a mental health crisis can get help from a qualified professional, either in person or by phone, within an hour of contact, and to help diffuse the crisis and avoid hospitalization. And teams can also refer folks in crisis to crisis apartments where they can stay for up to a week. And those are based in the community rather than the hospital. But we'd love to see this mobile crisis model go statewide, as I know.
Yeah, where is that? I remember hearing about that model, and people were excited about it, and there were going to be pilots in Manchester and Concord. Where does that stand now, Andrew?
So in terms of statewide implementation of mobile crisis, I don't know that there is any really effort on the legislative or policy side to make that happen. The legislature did authorize funding for a fourth mobile team that would be in another area of the state with a high rate of admissions to New Hampshire Hospital. And that hasn't happened either. We've apparently there were some obstacles to getting bids to make that happen, and we've advocated for some solutions or some ways to try to overcome those barriers and move toward the expansion of mobile crisis rather than, say, like a site-based crisis treatment center where people who are in mental health crisis would be expected to get themselves to a facility that might be very far away in order to present for care.
Another big hole that your group identified, Andrew, is housing. Again, instead of segregating people, getting people integrated into the community. And as you know, there's a huge housing shortage in general in New Hampshire.
Right.
What do you see when you look at the housing situation and your particular efforts to get people struggling with mental illness living in the community, in housing?
So we've seen an expansion of supported housing for people with mental illness thanks to the community mental health agreement. Hundreds of people have received that benefit where they get money toward an apartment in the community rather than in a segregated facility or congregate housing. But there have been funding limitations and eligibility limitations that mean that there are still a lot of people who really need supported housing and aren't able to receive it. And the state has been expanding transitional housing a lot, which I think is very important to distinguish from supported housing. Because supported housing is permanent with tenancy rights and it's scattered site rather than congregate housing.
Congregate is everybody living, lots of people living in one place?
Yeah, well, lots of people with mental health diagnoses who have been recently discharged from the hospital. That's more transitional housing where
sure.
It's a more restricted setting. It's a lot of the transitional housing is actually on the campus of New Hampshire Hospital, and it's not integrated in the community, meaning that folks who are living in transitional housing are not living in regular apartments with all kinds of people. Rather, it's all folks who have been hospitalized and are coming out of that.
I see.
So, that's an important piece of the puzzle, but it's not the solution that we really need in order to help people maintain be integrated in the community and stay out of the hospital.
Yeah, so it's not that integration that you want. It's sort of a continuation of the segregation that brought you to bring this lawsuit in the first place. Andrew Milne, I have to wrap you up there. I really appreciate you being with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us, and thanks for doing the series.
Andrew Milne, staff attorney with the Disability Rights Center of New Hampshire. Now, coming up, we'll start taking your questions and comments. So send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We'll also talk about the role of the private sector, especially private insurers and private hospitals, their role in improving the state's mental health system. All that's coming up, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I've been an NHPR member for just about 20 years, and this year I decided to become a sustaining member.
Nancy DeBosque of Keene.
I think NHPR has tremendous value, and it's local, so I really do like to know what's going on in my state and use that information a lot in my work.
Thousands of listeners like Nancy support NHPR with ongoing monthly contributions, and you can too. Invest in independent local news and become a sustainer today at nhpr.org and click on donate.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we go in-depth, spending the week on the state's mental health system. This hour, it's an overview of how it works, who's involved, where the gaps are. Send us an email with your questions and comments, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, today, it's an overview of the state's mental health system and what is better, what is not, since a major legal settlement was signed almost 5 years ago. Tomorrow, we'll focus on youth and children. Wednesday, the intersection between the mental health system and the criminal justice system. And then on Thursday, we'll focus more closely on this issue of New Hampshire Hospital and its role. Join us now again with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. And Katya Fox, Ken Norton, let's go to our listeners. Dan is in Nashua. Dan, thank you for calling in. Go ahead.
Thanks so much. I just wanted to convey a word of appreciation to the Disability Rights Center and all those who've been advocating on behalf of people with mental disabilities. A close family member of mine was institutionalized in the Concord State Hospital, the New Hampshire State Hospital in Concord, for a decade. And throughout that time, we tried very much to have him at least transitioned out to a more supportive community setting, a more integrated setting. And that finally happened about 5 years ago, and we have to believe it was as a direct or indirect result of the lawsuit that this dear family member was able to make that big transition and start building some semblance of a normal life. It's not an easy path. It takes a long time, but to have so many years essentially lost, institutionalized, was very painful for everyone involved, and I'm grateful that we've made at least some progress, and grateful also for the leadership that the former Chief Justice John Broderick has shown in really hitting the streets and bringing this message to countless people.
So wow. Dan, what a story. Thank you so much for calling, and I'm sure Andrew Milne is still listening from the Disability Rights Center and heard your praise. So thank you for the call. So he talked about New Hampshire Hospital, the struggle to get his loved one into community-based housing, where, as Andrew explained, is just better for the person. What do you think about this, Katya?
I think that it brings up a really good point that there are individuals at New Hampshire Hospital, and I know you're going to be talking more about this on Thursday, who, but for the supports in the community and the housing availability, would be able to live in an integrated setting. And an integrated setting means that people aren't isolated, and so that all individuals with severe mental illness are in one spot, that they're integrated just like anybody else into the community, and making choices about where they live and with whom they live and what type of setting. So we have a request for applications out that is, I believe the applications are due today, to look at community residences, which are an ability to set up those supports in a apartment or housing like a house-like setting that is for four or less individuals. And these are specifically designed for individuals coming out of New Hampshire Hospital so that they can achieve the success that was just described by the caller.
Well, and Dan, thank you again for the call. And I'm glad your story ended up well, although it took a long time. Ken, one of you mentioned earlier the issue of stigma, and you and I have talked about this a lot before. Stigma often comes up with mental illness. How hard is it to find these community housing places given the stigma that mental illness has? It's hard enough to find housing for anyone in New Hampshire, but I wonder especially for this group of people.
I think it's still very difficult, and I think that there are
There's
still
a fear factor, isn't there?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And, you know, when you hear New Hampshire Hospital or you hear, like, Dan's family member that had been there for a period of time, then that raises that fear factor or, you know, that feeling like, well, I don't want to be renting to this person, or I don't want this person living next door to me, or what if, you know, what if, what if, what if?
What if, what if, what?
Yeah. Well, whatever. I mean, people's, you know, it's again the conundrum about mental illness, and what we read in the media are those sensational stories, and what we don't read about are those successful stories like Dan's family member that go back and lead lives that are productive and, you know, in their communities. That's much harder to see.
And the reality is these are people who are living with us already. You know, we always act as if they're not already here. Well, I don't want them living next to me. Well, they're here because they're your family members, they're your neighbors, and so it's actually quite puzzling to me. We need to put faces to this issue.
Which is, again, part of the effort that former Chief Justice Broderick is doing. Again, Dan and Ashwa, great to hear from you. You can join us, too. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call like Dan did, 1-800-892-6477. I want to bring another person into our conversation, both of you. On the line with us is Steve Annan, president of the New Hampshire Hospital Association. And Steve, welcome back. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning.
So what is the private hospital sector's role in improving New Hampshire's mental health system, Steve, given that now, you know, hospitals aren't just that standalone building, the hospital, but they really are running, you know, healthcare systems in their communities. So what's your role in all this?
Well, certainly hospitals have seen the challenge facing these patients on a daily basis, you know, given the fact that we've had a wait list for certainly almost as long as I've been in New Hampshire, which is almost 10 years now. The challenge is tremendous, and hospitals are working very, very hard in collaboration with their community mental health centers and with others to try and make sure that patients who are waiting in the ED are stabilized and that they're safe and that they are able to move as quickly as they can to the state hospital. I think what really this points to is there's simply a lack of capacity in the overall health system, behavioral health system here in New Hampshire to treat patients with an acute psychiatric crisis. And, you know, we have to do so many things. And as your guests there have already talked about, there have been a number of things that have occurred over the last couple of years. And I think it's due to a lot of their leadership and others. You know, I think it was about a year ago, Concord Hospital hosted several visits with key leaders, including the governor, the commissioner, Senate president, and others, to visit the emergency department at Concord Hospital to see firsthand what it means for a patient to be waiting in the emergency department before getting the care that they need at an acute psychiatric hospital.
Yeah, often makes the situation worse, hanging out in the emergency room, or the ED, as you call it.
Exactly, and certainly hospitals are working very hard on new modalities, early directed therapy, and other types of things to help patients who are there. But again, how do we avoid people needing those services? I've heard you talk about the sort of community action teams, mobile crisis teams, and other things are absolutely essential. We have to find ways to expand capacity throughout the system, not just in terms of the inpatient capacity, but we do need more inpatient capacity because there are people who will need those services at some time. But as Katja and others have just talked about, we need to make certain that we can move people out of the hospital into a more appropriate setting, opening up additional capacity at the state hospital. I think there's a lot of work that's going on, and as I've testified before the legislature, there isn't just one thing that we have to do. We have to do everything, and we have to do it now. We have to find a way to put additional resources. The legislature and governor have been tremendous in helping to move this along, but we need to do more. We need to increase, as you talked about earlier, increase rates for the community behavioral health centers, increase rates for hospitals that run the involuntary facilities that they do run so that they are sustainable, so that they can attract the workforce, so that they can maintain those services now and in the long term. Again, we've got a lot to do. I'm optimistic, but again, we have more work to do.
And Steve, let me jump in on you if I could for just a moment, please. So a couple years ago, more like 5, 6, 7 years ago, emergency room docs really brought this issue to the forefront, saying, look, you know, we're supposed to be treating victims of car crashes and people with broken legs, and we have people in a mental health crisis waiting in emergency rooms for hours and hours, if not days and days. How is that situation now? Has the sort of daily number of people waiting in a mental health crisis, how has that improved? Are we still seeing large numbers of people in that situation?
We still have large numbers of people. At the end of last week, we had 39 adults in emergency rooms and three children in emergency rooms around the state. And Ken and I participated in a press conference that he and NAMI organized a number of years ago. And at the time, we were talking about 10 to 20 patients a day. And now, you know, we're talking about 40 to 50, sometimes even more patients a day. So again, we've made progress. Some of it is not always visible, but we have much more work to do in order to stem this crisis. And again, I feel confident that we have a number of leaders in place. The new CEO at the hospital, Lori Chibanet, has been incredibly helpful. And I think one of the things that we can do, and we've been trying to do through the association, is to become better partners and partners with the state hospital, with the community mental health centers, and others, so that we are working together to solve this problem. And it's not just the state hospital over here and the community hospitals over here, but really trying to look at this from a systems perspective.
So let me ask about that partnership, Steve. And there has been some criticism that hospitals themselves used to be more partners in this, but that over the past decade or two, they've closed their psychiatric units for business reasons. It just didn't bring in enough cash, contributing to what we see today. So I wonder if, you know, you guys have been part of the problem by closing these units, reducing that capacity.
Actually, Laura, there are actually more private psychiatric beds in the state today than there were back in 2011. They may not always all be in the same place, and there are economic challenges that do face organizations, and you know, the reimbursement rates that are offered for these services often are far less than the cost of providing the service. You've talked about the workforce challenges that we face. And so there are significant challenges. And as I said, we've got more work to do. We've added resources. But again, I think we have much more that needs to be done if we're going to create a sustainable system over time. And hospitals certainly have been a part of the solution, and we want to continue to be part of the solution.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Steve Onan, president of the New Hampshire Hospital Association. Again, talking about the role of the private sector in this issue of New Hampshire's mental health system. We're looking at how it's been working, some of the improvements, a lot of the gaps. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Katya, in addition to the emergency room issue, and we've talked about that with Steve Onan, the state itself has come under criticism for improperly transferring some people with mental illness, not to the state hospital, but to the state prison, including people who haven't committed a crime. This is the conversation, and it's a bigger conversation than we'll have time for today, about the secure psychiatric unit of the prison. At the prison, how is the state addressing that concern that some people aren't being appropriately moved to the psychiatric unit in the prison?
I am going to punt on this one. I think that's an area that is being debated and has been for years in the legislature. And I really think that the conversation is ongoing. I know that there was recent legislation that has to do with the Department of Corrections on that very issue. And so I think that's ongoing.
Is that a policymaker decision, though, like a legislative decision and not so much a nuts and bolts at the DHHS level decision? I'm just wondering who makes those decisions.
I think it's more complicated than just one or the other.
Do you want to jump in on that, Ken?
Sure.
That's been a big issue in the media anyway.
You know, I mean, 30 years ago, the secure psychiatric unit was in the main building at New Hampshire Hospital.
Really?
Yes. And, you know, and at a point in time, the legislature decided to move it to the prison. There was a lot of political pressure at the time relative to the community not wanting it necessarily where it was on Pleasant Street. There had been some incidents that occurred there. So it came under the auspices of the Department of Corrections. And at that point in time, then there was this gap between some people who are not able to be managed at New Hampshire Hospital because of their safety or the safety of others, who then end up being transferred to the secure psychiatric unit.
I see. So, and this predates my time hosting the show. So, and it's interesting because I actually live in the neighborhood of New Hampshire Hospital. So the area around there, some people said, boy, these, you know, people who seem to have a lot of issues, we don't feel safe, and we want them put, the secure psychiatric unit, put in the Department of Corrections so that we don't have to worry that these folks will escape and do bad things.
That was part of it.
That's
and
the
yes,
oversimplified
there were a couple of high-profile escapes that, you know, that resulted in tragedies.
Okay. And so it was a political decision, a policy decision, as Katya said, mm-hmm. to move it over to the Corrections Department. And now we have the situation where some people feel like it's being overused and that it's not a medical facility, even though people have a medical problem, a mental illness
problem.
Well,
it's commingling prisoners with people who aren't prisoners, and that, you know, and that's problematic. And, you know, and families have to go through correctional visitation requirements that they would not have to go through if the person was at New Hampshire Hospital.
Well, and maybe we'll touch more on that on Wednesday when we look at the intersection of the criminal justice system and the mental health system. A couple more questions for all of you before we wrap up. And Ken, to you first, we've talked so much on this program about the state's opioid crisis, and I wonder what links you see between the problems in the mental health system and the opioid crisis.
Well, there's a lot of links, and you know, and this maybe gets back to the questions with Steve about the hospitals and overall, looking at people as whole people and not as segregated. You know, they're going to get their mental health treatment here. They're going to get their drug misuse treatment here. They're going to get their physical health treatment here. You know, at the extreme end of things, obviously the connection between drug overdose deaths and suicide is something that ultimately the medical examiner sorts out, and that disregard for life or what are being described as deaths of despair. And you know, and the bigger piece, I think, is that with opioids, with mental illness, there is a very high co-occurrence of physical disorders. So people that have pain or have other physical health medical conditions, and the overlap between mental illness and substance misuse is very high there.
So do you think that that we've spent too much time focusing on opioids, and money from the feds and money from the state to the detriment of the mental health system?
No, I mean, I think that the opioid crisis is a huge crisis, and you know, and people are dying, but not just dying. People are, you know, less visibly having problems, children ending up in foster care, or people being unable to parent, or, you know, or people's parents ending up caring for their children, so grandparents running families. The problems are huge, and employers feel it. We really, I think we've done a good job trying to address the complexities of a very challenging problem.
Katya, you mentioned earlier in the program about a new 10-year plan. We don't have time to go into all the questions that I have about this, but I guess my main question is, why do we need a new 10-year plan?
So if we look at the plan from 2008.
It's a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. There are some pieces in there that we did not implement. And one is some of the group housing that was referenced earlier by Andrew, the group homes. So what we have the opportunity to do and why we need a new plan is because there have been many new models that have emerged. It's like mobile crisis, like the urgent care center for behavioral health that was referenced by Andrew earlier as well. And those are the types of models and practices that we want to be able to implement in New Hampshire.
All right, both of you, we barely scratched the surface, but we've got all the rest of the week to look at New Hampshire's mental health system more in depth. I want to thank both of you very much for being here. Thank you. That's Katya Fox, Director of the Division for Behavioral Health at DHHS, and Ken Norton, Executive Director of NAMI-NH. Coming up, we continue our Race for the First series. Every Monday, we're meeting one of the many candidates for the first congressional district. Up next is Democrat Mark McKenzie. You can listen to our interview and watch it on Facebook Live. So go to NHPR's Facebook page. You'll find it there. All that's coming up, so stay with us.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.